the first hour of the program talking about the fact that the people of the Philippines were not prepared for what hit them individually, and that America is ill-equipped economically for what's about to befall the country. Because it's important that you recognize you ought not be dependent upon government. You ought to be, in terms of your family, as self-reliant as possible, and in terms of your soul, as Yahweh reliant as is possible. Now, Yahweh makes it pretty easy. Doesn't has no taxes. Doesn't ask anything financially of us. No, doesn't even ask for tithes or offerings. He simply asks that we meet him seven times a year at the parties that he throws and on our behalf. He paid the toll to redeem us, to pay off our debt. It is the antithesis of what we find in governments and individuals now across the nation and the world. But there was a realization that a time occurred in our past some 5,000 years ago where mankind became so corrupt there was only one family that was responsible. And in fact, Noah was chosen, we learned, because he was responsible in his own family. It was the way that Noah dealt with his family was the entire reason that Yahweh chose him. That's something that should be sobering to us as we consider the consequence of the discussion that Craig Smith and I had in the first hour of the program. We have, of course, reached a time where mankind is far more corrupt and far more in debt and far less responsible, far less devoted to family than 5,000 years ago during Noah's time. It's much worse today. And so the consequences are going to be far worse today. It's just that Yahweh is not going to clean the planet with water, nor is he just going to deal with one small region of the planet. Upon his return, he will come back as light energy, and all of those who are not enveloped in his set-apart spirit will be instantly vaporized. And good riddance. God said to Noah, I am pruning all humans who are related, moving about before me. Indeed, the region is filled with terrorism, lawlessness, and cruelty because of their presence. Look here now, I will bring ruin to them along with their region. Ruin to them was shahat. I will catch them in the pit and basin that they have made, and I will cause them to decay and to decompose, wiping them out by laying waste to them. Yahweh has set a precedent. If you are into Hamas, terrorism, lawlessness, and cruelty that are perpetrated by religion, politics, economic schemes, and militaries, if you are into Hamas, that, as I say, is almost universally perpetrated by religion, political institutions, military institutions, and economic institutions, if you are into Hamas, Yahweh has said that I will cause ruin, that you will decompose, you'll be wiped out. God is not going to incorporate terrorists, those who are Torahless, those who are cruel, destructive, and plundering into his home. There will be no religious, political, military, or economic schemers in heaven. The basin reference here is important. Please keep it in mind as we move forward because it explains the nature of the flood. Now, just as gardeners prune plants to cut out decay and to promote healthy growth, God was prepared to remove corrupt humans for the sake of those who had yet not been contaminated. Now, that was something he could do 5,000 years ago because one man was righteous within his family, upright within his family, responsible within his family. I'm not sure he could do that today because now we have billions who are corrupt. Now, while God could have made the vessel that he used to save Noah and his family himself, or that he could have found a much more straightforward way to protect Noah, his family, and the animals. God prefers doing things with us. That is just his style. He created the universe and conceived life specifically because he likes doing things with us. That's what he gets out of it. That's the only benefit that God has for the creation of the universe and the conception of life is to enjoy doing things with us. And so the whole story of Noah, of this man who loved doing things with his family and protecting his family and nurturing his family and sheltering his family, is the example of what God wants to do with all of us through the covenant. And so he used this man in this way, working together, creating an ark of the covenant for Noah's family, because that is indeed what God intends with those of us who choose to be adopted into the covenant. Yahweh never misses an opportunity to reinforce his message, giving us the opportunity to revel in the brilliance of his word as he intertwines amazingly sophisticated and relevant metaphors. The very nature of the ark is symbolic, and there would be two of them, not one. Let's consider the nature of the ark. By the way, while there are two arks in this story, in Yahweh's Torah testimony, they represent the same covenant. One covenant, two metaphors regarding arks that draw our attention to God's heart's desire, which is that we participate with him in his covenant family. One is the Ark of the Covenant. The other is the Ark that protected Noah's family. More than this, by building a gargantuan vessel 600 miles from the nearest ocean, and that's how far the Ark was constructed from the nearest large body of water. And it was a gargantuan vessel by any standards, even today's standards. God not only memorialized for our benefit how Noah engaged with him, but also provided his critics and doubters with an overt last warning of, let's say, biblical proportions. There is little doubt that Noah's shipbuilding exploits were featured regularly in the Black Sea Gazette. Everyone in the Eretz region would have known about it. And that's because God wants everyone, and that includes those who have turned their backs on him and have chosen to rely on political and religious solutions, their military or economic schemes. He wants everyone to be without excuse. Further, Noah's undaunted confidence and sense of purpose in the face of unending ridicule demonstrated the benefit of Yada knowing Yahweh. If you had been open-minded watching Noah's fortitude and perseverance, you'd be compelled to contemplate what or whom he knew that you didn't. As such, Noah's example demonstrates the difference between faith and trust, between believing and relying. It was, therefore, a wake-up call that was missed by the mockers, just as Yada Yah goes unnoticed among those on the cusp of being swept up in another rising storm. Yada Yah, the nature of the name of the first six volumes of books that I wrote devoted to Yahweh's prophetic statements and the teachings associated with them. An Introduction to God is based upon Yahweh's seven most important themes: his word, his name, his covenant. And we go on through the list of things that are vital to know about God. Even Questioning Paul was written specifically so that everyone might have the opportunity to know why they ought not rely on the Christian religion, why they will drown, cease to exist if they do. But most of those books, even Prophet of Doom, which exposes and condemns Islam, are ignored by most people. But they're without excuse. The answers are there. They're free. They're available around the world. As a matter of fact, it's interesting to note that Prophet of Doom, which exposes and condemns Islam based upon its own scriptures, Muhammad's words and deeds, has higher readership per capita in places like Iran and Iraq and throughout the Islamic world than it does in the free world, even in English-speaking countries. Now, as we continue to make our way through Yah's testimony, let's hear what God has to tell us. He, speaking through Noah, and the only reason that he recorded this testimony with Noah was for our benefit, so that we might know what it's like to listen to God's instructions, to his guidance, and to respond. God said, engage. I want you to engage by making. This is Asha, Ata. I want you yourself to engage by making a timber ark, an esh, a wooden ark, a boat, a large ship, which is waterproof and will float, a teva, of resinous lumber and tar, of laminated wood. Construct stalls, this would be kin, rooms, nests, and beds, on the ship, on the teva, the boat, our ark. And cover, kafar, coat, as an envelop, parts of her, living quarters, beth, family homes, houses, and rooms. And exterior, the shoots outside, in pitch, kofur, tar, and other natural bituminous material like asphalt used to seal a vessel. This is from Bavrishith 6:14. If we were left with only Hebrew, gofar would be anything from cedar. This was, gofar was the resinous lumber and tar, which is laminated wood, properly translated. But gofar could be anything from cedar to a species of tree which has become known to us, or an elevated superstructure constructed of in the style of a large chest, to logs with a high resin content, even to sulfur as a heat source. All of that is germane to the etymology of gofar, which would have been used in metallurgy, the sulfur as a heat source, and therefore used in the process of making rivets to hold the ship together. But upon further investigation, we learned that the Aramaic root of gofar means laminated wood. So Yahweh was specifically instructing, providing guidance to Noah to make this ship out of laminated wood. Now we'll consider why after the commercial break. Considering gopher, in that Yahweh said that I want you to make this ark out of gopher, which is resinous lumber and tar, simply laminated wood, we find that all of the etymological shadings of gopher all seem to fit. Resin or tree sap is communicated by gopher, which would be the glue that was used to affect the laminate, and the sulfur, which would have generated heat, would have been used to bend the wood into the desired shape and to heat the resins so that they would be spreadable and then could dry and heat with the wood to form the glue lamps in today's parlance. And indeed, glue lamps, laminated wood, would be required to build a vessel of this size. Actually, laminated wood is stronger than is a single beam. And also, if you're dealing with a family without mechanization, it's much easier to move thinner boards and glue them together than it would be to try to build a ship and move beams that would have required heavy mechanization in the day. So God is giving us one insight here that he knew what he was talking about. He knew who he was dealing with, Noah and his sons and his wives and daughters, his wife and daughters. And so glue lamps would be the order of the day. Of particular interest in relation to the ark is Yahweh's use of kafar, which means to coat, covering something. It's the same word Yahweh selected to convey the purpose of Yom Kippurim, Kippur, from which we get Kippurim, the Day of Reconciliations, is based upon this concept of covering, of coating, of providing a protective cover. Kafar means to repair the damage done by an offense by making amends. This is a very specific form of forgiveness, which includes a pardon leading to reconciliation, and it is designed as a means of protection. And it is what Yahweh does through his set-apart spirit. He provides us with a garment of light, which is the protective covering. The Garden of Eden was a protected and covered garden, same as is the Ark. The Ark of the Covenant and the Ark that Noah was building was considered a protective covering, all from Kafar. Kafar is used specifically in the description of the Ark of the Covenant and the Mercy Seat, which is an aspect of it. It is where, you know, the Ark of the Covenant and the Mercy Seat is where Yahweh instructed the Lohi, meaning those who unite, corrupted to mean Levites, to sprinkle the blood of the sacrificial lamb to resolve the consequence of man's sins. As a merciful cover, Kafar is symbolic of the garment of light which Yahweh's set-apart spirit adorns those of us who embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant. The garment of light precludes God from seeing any of the offenses we commit. In fact, it obliterates them because where there is light, there is no darkness, causing us to be perfect in God's eyes. Now, you want to keep this connection to the spirit in mind as we work through Yah's instructions regarding the Ark as well as the Mikre, these called-out assembly meetings, where God specifically, on four of them, asked us to come into the presence of the spiritual light, the maternal aspect of his light. Now, the reason that Yahweh introduced this concept so early, telling Noah to kafar, or coat and cover, the ark inside and out, was make sure that we wouldn't miss this metaphor. There is more to God's protection than planks and timber. For the same reason, Yahweh called the entirety, the entity, if you will, being coated, a bereth. Now, Be'eth in Hebrew means home, household, family. Be'eth is the basis of Be'eth, which is the covenant. So he is adroitly connecting the Be'eth covenant to the Be'eth family that it serves to this ark where the thing being coated and protected was the Be'eth, the house, the home for the household of God. The symbolism here is that God wants to provide a protection for his family, his home on earth. Lastly, you'll notice that the ark's interior was covered in bituminous pitch, which is a byproduct of carbon, which is a byproduct of life and death. It was not covered in resin or sap. You know, fundamentalist Christians want the world to believe that the planet and universe are a little more than 6,000 year old. Yeah, well, that's not possible for there to be natural tar, a compound which would have had to have been readily available for God's instructions to availed themselves in this situation. So we had lots of death and dying taking place outside of the garden. Be back in a moment. Hello, welcome back to Sharing Mist. I'm your host, Yana. We have Nick calling in from Wisconsin. Nick was a frequent caller. Haven't heard from Nick in the past month or so. Good to hear from you, Nick. Welcome back to Shattering Mist.
Good morning. So,
you know, Nick, you're named after a Greek god.
Huh.
Yeah, Nike, the Greek god of victory. It's the, in fact, in Christianity, the Nicene Creed and the Council of Nicaea. It's also named after the same Greek god. But yes,
so
indeed,
their gods are fake.
Yes. Yes. Well, actually, it isn't too bad. I'm glad those gods are fake, because I choose to have a relationship with the real one, and he is not. He doesn't have much an affinity for fake ones.
Well, maybe I'll start my own religion, and I'll have I'll make myself as a god.
Yeah, my suggestion would be not to do that.
Hey,
anyway, Mohammed, I understand you have a question or a comment on the ark. Go ahead.
Today's mm-hmm. Technology and science have uh-huh. discovered that in human DNA mm-hmm. contains like DNA of pretty much everything that's on this planet, every living mm-hmm. organism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my question is, could our DNA to be that one ship that is Torah is talking about, and not literally a ship, but a DNA, you know, but
yeah.
talking about this ship inside. I mean, this way he would have to save only one person, Noah, and then
yeah.
repopulate
yeah,
the whole planet with just using
yeah.
one DNA.
Yeah, there's a lot of misnomer that is common that is in your question, Nick. First of all, Yahweh didn't flood the entire planet. He only flooded the area of Mesopotamia where there were humans with an asalma or a conscience. And it's as we go through the story, you'll find that that's the only region he flooded. And therefore, he was only interested in saving humans with a nasama. There were many humans around the world, Homo sapiens, that didn't have a nasama at the time, and they were not affected. Also, he had no interest in saving animals that existed outside of Mesopotamia, the area from the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates River in eastern Turkey down to the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in what is currently Iraq. The issue with DNA is that it is a language. It's if there ever was proof of a designer, it's DNA. DNA is a language where the written with an alphabet. But the unique thing about DNA is a language in three dimensions. You know, while we look at a book, letters on a book or a page are in two dimensions. DNA is an alphabet that is written in three dimensions, but it's clearly an alphabet, and therefore had a designer. The DNA is different between various forms of animals, which is how they appear differently. And Homo sapiens have different DNA than do dogs, for example. Our DNA is unique. Now, there are many the letters that comprise the alphabet for life is the same. It's written differently, just like the letters that comprise the words on the book. Advocating horrible things and positive things use the same letters. They're just put in a different arrangement. There really is an ark. The ark has been found. Just east of Lake Van, you can Google the Turkish national park to the ark, and you can actually see the boat via the satellite imagery on Google Earth. The ark has been found. There was a real boat. It matches the mentions that God describes here. It was found in the region that God said it would be found. And you can see it. So there really was an ark.
I have one more question then.
Sure.
Now, because we are able to manipulate mm-hmm. the DNA and create mm-hmm. a new species, hybrids, human fish hybrids or whatever, mm-hmm. Would that be considered we can do things God did once?
Yeah, it's interesting. We have limited ability to manipulate DNA. We can splice DNA, for example. But that's very different than God creating DNA and then conceiving, not only conceiving the alphabet, but conceiving life. What we're able to do is take existing DNA and splice it into existing DNA. We're not creating DNA. And we're not creating life. We're simply splicing aspects of one animal's DNA to another animal in that species. And so our ability to play God is extraordinarily limited in that regard. So I think we have to be rather careful. Yahweh created the universe as we know it. He conceived life as we know it. He is the author of DNA. And just being able to understand that
play
the alphabet, the language of life, is DNA, to recognize that that's the language of life, and to be able to actually have conceived the language, those things are fairly significantly disparaging.
So in a simpler way, it's like he created the alphabet, we just able to play with letters. When
we might
be able to create a new alphabet, then when we're gonna, but
correct.
Up until then, we only allowed or can't play with the letters that he, that he created.
Right. You know, a company in Europe, I think Sweden, created Legos, the children's building blocks out of plastic, and they manufacture them, and they have all sorts of designs for them, and young children play with them around the world. The young children didn't create them. They simply play with them. Even a more extreme version of that would be true with God. Yeah, he created the building blocks, and we play with the building blocks, and not all that well. I might add.
What would be considered a creation then? If I play with the DNA, part of that and part of the other one.
Yeah, that's not creating. That's manipulating.
Yes. Combine them and get the end result, something new that is not yet existed, but made out of the building blocks that was created by someone else, which is Yahweh.
Yeah. We can manipulate life. We can't create life. You know, there used to be, going back 20, 25, 30 years ago, there were lots of government-funded research projects in the conception of life, and these research projects and universities used to have the primordial ooze. They would have lots of carbon-based and organic materials in these test tubes, and lots of water, vapor, and all the everything was conducive to life in these with organic materials in these test tubes, and they would interject electrical current, some outside force, to try to see if they could create life in a test tube. And they never even came close. I mean, not even remotely close. And all such research has been disbanded. There is no research now on actually doing what you're talking about, creating life. Scientists have realized that it is way beyond the possibility of random chance or even of them trying to manipulate all the ingredients. We can't
create
life.
Well, science is not over yet. We're not done yet there, don't you think? Who knows what?
No, I think the reason that there's no research in the conception of life arena is that they realize that the likelihood of conceiving life from even organic materials is far less than having a tornado fly over a junkyard and having the result being a 747 that emerges and flies out of the junkyard. We're nowhere close. It's the same kind of thing as to the composition of the universe itself. We finally come to realize that we only can have a primitive understanding of 4% of the substance of the universe. 96% of the substance of the universe, we really have no clue what it's even comprised of, and we don't even have a method of describing it.
Okay, completely different question.
Okay.
I hear this word Elohim a lot in here and there, popping up here, popping out there. I don't quite know or don't remember what does Torah says about this particular name.
Yeah, it's not a name. It's a common word. It's derived from Eloah. Eloah means Almighty or Mighty One. Eloah is the Hebrew word that we would translate God. It means Mighty One or Almighty Eloah. The shortened version of Eloah is El, and the plural version of Eloah is Elohim. Y-M just means plural. Now, Yahweh is not saying that he is plural, but he does have a maternal and a paternal and a maternal nature, and there are two manifestations of Yahweh that interact with us in our world. But Elohim, most effectively translated in English, would be God, or Mighty One, or Almighty.
Okay. Well, thank you for answering the question.
Sure. Sure. Elohim and El and Eloah are not names. God is not a name. When people refer to, you know, pray to God, well, you know, there's lots of gods, and most gods, 99.9999% of gods are fake gods. Yahweh,
including the one I was named after.
Including the one you were named after, Nick, is a false god. And so Yahweh wants you to know that He alone is God, and He uses the title Elohim to not only describe Himself but also false gods. So Elohim is not a word to be revered. It isn't a word to hold out in any unique position. It's just simply one of the many Hebrew words that Yahweh used to describe both Himself and false gods.
One more question. Maybe I'm just too confused, but I think when you talk about Paul and what does Torah says about him and mm-hmm. you know, his real name Shaul and mm-hmm. other bad things, and then when you talk about Muhammad and what does Torah says about mm-hmm. him, I mm-hmm. see both two people but similar discussion, similar of everything, and I'm wondering if that's what is the distinction between two, where why.
Oh, boy, that's a great question. Yeah, we're playing the music, which means that we're going to go to the last segment of Shattering
Myths. I'll take my answer offline.
You betcha. I will answer the question as best I can in the 6 minutes we have remaining of the program after the commercial break. Thank you, Nick. Always great to hear from you. Back to the final segment of Shattering Myths for today. Nick left us with a compelling question, which was to compare the stories of Paul and Muhammad. He said that they seem quite similar, and I would agree with him. They are quite similar. One is the founder of the Christian religion. The other one is the founder of the Islamic religion. They were born about 570 years apart, maybe 565 years approximately apart. Both claimed to be demon-possessed. Muhammad claimed to be demon-possessed during his first revelation. And he described his first revelation very similar to what Paul did. He said he was beat to the precipice of death and had to recover for days from the assault of the dark spirit that met with him. So both Muhammad and Paul described their first meetings very similarly with the dark spirit that inspired them both to claim to be demon-possessed. Muhammad, during the end of his life, Paul, in his letter to the Corinthians, in the second letter to the Corinthians, admits to being demon-possessed. They both claimed to speak for God, and yet they both contradicted everything that the God that they claimed to speak for had said, which means that they were both overt liars. Message that they conveyed was different in the sense that Paul replaced the Yahweh's Torah with faith, a belief in what he was saying, and Muhammad replaced the Yahweh's Torah with belief in what he was offering. Paul's message was a belief in the gospel of grace, which is the name of a pagan goddess, and for Muhammad it was profession that he was the messenger of God. Just as you have to profess essentially to be a Christian, that Paul is the messenger of God. Now, Paul's message was more peaceful than was Muhammad's. Muhammad's articulated a message of carnage, of fighting, of jihad. And so they were different in the sense that jihad is the implement of salvation in Islam, killing in Allah's cause. That the name of their gods is different, and with Paul it was Jesus Christ, and with Muhammad it was Allah. But other than nuances in their message, both come right from the same place of of worshiping the Lord, of being inspired and being possessed by a Lord who is none other than Satan, and of telling everyone that they were God's spokesperson and that to be saved, you must believe them. You must acknowledge that they were God's spokesperson. So very similar characters. Paul, based upon what Yahweh has said and what Paul says, was probably a homosexual. Muhammad was a pedophile. These are not normal human behaviors. In terms of their message, extraordinarily similar, particularly from the place that they have come and their overt commitment to disavow the Torah. Now, it's interesting with Paul, since he knew the Torah well, he simply quoted it and twisted its message. With Muhammad, who was dumb as a stone, Muhammad didn't know the Torah, and therefore he didn't quote it. He didn't twist it to serve his agenda. What Muhammad did is he took stories that the rabbis told him from their Talmud, and he bastardized them to serve his agenda. So both ended up with a highly corrupt and perverted version of the Torah, which was designed to satiate their own personal lust for power and for influence. But very different, or very similar men. With that, I do want to return to the story of the Ark. Yahweh leaves us with this comment. He says, these are her production relationships. These are her manufacturing relationships. The Ark's length is to be 300 cubits. Her width is to be 50 cubits. And her height is to be 30 cubits. Now, we don't have a lot of time left today, but as we return to this story in tomorrow's program, we're going to look at this this production or manufacturing relationship of the Ark at 300 cubits at length, 50 cubits in height, and 30 cubits in height and 50 in width, and going to consider the Royal Egyptian cubit, which was known to Moshe at the time, what it represents, as well as the cubit, the Hebrew cubit, how they differ, and what it would mean for the dimensions of this ark and how it compares to modern vessels. Thank you for listening.